On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And there came at last the eve of an election like few others in modern memory, a midterm election being cast as a last-ditch national battle for the country's soul, for democracy, for accountability, for survival. In the news this week, red wine and California fire and a new global warming alarm. But the heart of it is all about the midterms. President Bush standing by his Rumsfeld on Iraq, John Kerry's October surprise and apology, a debate over who thinks we're more stupid, a tenured Democratic senator or a Republican government that has mired the country in war and division and debt. Up next on Point, a week in the news and the fiery home stretch to the midterm elections. Joining me today from Dallas, Texas, is William McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, a longtime Bushwatcher. Great to have you back with us, Bill.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Washington, Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. She's been following key races, most recently in Connecticut, Virginia, and Georgia. Andrea Stone, thank you so much for joining our Friday panel.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom, Bill, Andrea.
Hi.
All right. All kinds of headlines, but just thrumming through the whole thing is the midterm home stretch. Andrea, what's the big campaign headline this week? Where are we headed with this thing?
Iraq. I mean, that is what people are talking about. This is a referendum, and George Bush. This is a referendum. Even though George Bush isn't on the ballot, it's all about him, and it's all about this war.
Negroponte, we just heard on the news, suddenly popping up in Baghdad, talking with Prime Minister Maliki there right after top security advisor Stephen Hadley was there. What's up with this? Is there some special message being delivered, Andrew? What do you know about this visit?
Well, I think that the administration's having a discomfort, with Prime Minister al-Maliki this week ordered U.S. checkpoints in Baghdad near Sadr City to be dismantled. U.S. troops are looking for an Iraqi-born U.S. Translator who was kidnapped a few days ago. Mm-hmm. But these checkpoints were making life, which isn't really great in Baghdad as it is, even harder. And Maliki, who's trying to show a little bit of strength, he knows there's an election going on here. He basically said, take down those checkpoints. We have so much going on in Iraq in the news. And the Republicans, there's not much that they can do right now. The Democrats are promising a new direction. That's their slogan, although they haven't really given us any details on how they're going to, fix this mess over there. But I think that is what all the polls are showing. The vast majority of people are concerned about this war.
One wonders if it's just checkpoints that Negroponte is talking with Maliki about. This, of course, the Iraqi prime minister who called not long ago to President Bush and said, "Are you going to toss me out?" Bill McKenzie, you bring a kind of conservative eye to events across the nation and around the world. What do you see in the home stretch to this midterm election?
Well, I'm going to preface it by saying this is why politics is a lot of fun at the end. There's so many swirling parts and conflicting pieces of information and so much stuff happening at the end. My wife kind of hates me when I say this because it's all about the horse race, but it really gets fun kind of down towards the end of trying to figure this out. I don't know who the person was that you were having in your promo there, but there was somebody there from the South saying, look, nobody has a crystal ball. We really don't know what's going to happen. And I think that person is right. I think what we do know is that the House is going to look different, whether it's going to be Democratic-controlled or Republican-controlled. I don't know, but I think the margins are either going to be narrow or it's going to be in the Democrats' hands, and that's going to really kind of change the next particularly 6 months for the Bush administration. I was talking to a White House official yesterday about this, and they kind of understand that they're on the precipice of something that could change. They've already been sending some signals that they may want to try to do some bipartisan stuff. There's been some talk about it on the deficit. But I think the bottom line is, we're at the, I don't know what the metaphor is, we're mid-fourth quarter. Nobody knows exactly where this is going.
Bill McKenzie, give us your moderate conservative sort of temperature reading on this race. Are you rooting, gangbusters for the GOP this time, or are you in some kind of ambivalent mood? How do you see this race? You've been a Bush backer for a long time.
I'm rooting for a close margin in the Congress, and particularly in the House, because I think that will force the White House and Congress to try to work more center-right. I am not real happy when the administration tries to go just to the right. I don't think that is really, frankly, indicative of his compassionate conservatism. I don't think that's really what he ran on, but he's governed from that point a lot. I'd like to see him move back to the center-right, and if the margins are narrow, I think that will force their hands. For example, on the subject of immigration, which we've talked about before, the thing is still lingering out there. And if there is a close margin, perhaps there'll be enough Democratic votes and some moderate Republican votes to pass it. We'll have No Child Left Behind coming up for renewal next year. If it's a wide Democratic margin in the House, in my book, that's not good for renewal, No Child Left Behind. If you have a narrow margin, perhaps that increases the chances of doing something.
Jack Beatty, here's Bill McKenzie, a conservative in Dallas, looking at this and hoping for a narrow margin. We're not sure which way. What do you see in the numbers, Jack? What's coming down the pike here?
Well, the prognosticators are calling it the average I see from people like Stu Rothenberg, Cook, and others is 32 to 40 seats. That seems to be their estimates.
But 32 to 40 seats what?
For the Democrats in the House.
Whoa.
The best measure of congressional elections is the generic congressional ballot. The question, if the election were held today, would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat? Over 10 elections since 1950, that question of Gallup's has proven to be the best predictor. In 1994, the Republican lead over the Democrats in that dimension was 7. Today, the Democratic lead over the Republicans in that dimension is averaging at 14. The 7, by Gallup's calculation in 1994, converted into 48 House seats. That's how they projected it. And, of course, they were off by 6. It was 54. Now, if the Democrats are up by 14, what does that mean that converts into? We don't know. Some people say you have to subtract 5 from the Democratic total. That still puts them around 9 or 10, which is unprecedented in the congressional ballot, and which, as I say, is a predictor of a substantial Democratic victory.
So you're looking back at the models and saying you see in those numbers, or the prognosticators do, 32 or 40 seats swinging to Democrats. Of course, the GOP is not saying anything like that. Even Democrats are not exactly trumpeting that they're going to go there, Jack.
No, they're not, and they don't want to spread complacency. But look what's happening. I mean, I live in the second district of New Hampshire, and up here 2 years ago, our incumbent congressman, Charles Bass, a moderate Republican, beat his Democratic challenger, Paul Hodes, by 20 points. Hodes is now up by 7. The Republicans are spending money in Idaho. They're spending money in Nebraska, which, as Ken Rudin said this morning on NPR, hasn't gone Democrat since 1066. They're spending money in Arizona. That's telling you something. It's telling you that even their incumbents they would have thought would be completely protected because of where they live are not so safe now because there's a wave.
In trouble deep in the bastion, maybe. Andrea Stone, how do you see it? That big a wave out there? What are the polls and your direct conversations telling you here just a few days before the vote?
I agree with that. You know, it's interesting to see where President Bush is yesterday and the next few days till the election. He's in places like Montana and Nebraska, and he's going to Colorado, which will be interesting because there's 3 House races that are contested there, as well as the governor's race. And, you know, I think this story about the evangelical pastor is, you know, it's hard to know, but, you know, Colorado Springs.
Ted Haggard, head of the National Association of Evangelicals, allegedly supposed to have had a gay sex relationship with a prostitute.
Right, although
resigned.
I saw. Right. And according to an email sent out by the church, which I read on NPR, he has confessed to something or some of it. But in any event, the president is going to Colorado, and there are several seats there. That is sort of the center of, focus on the family and some of these other Christian conservative groups. And of course, they have a same-sex marriage ballot initiative on that people will be voting for in Colorado and in several other states. So it's going to be interesting to see, what effect this will have, if any, if some of the more conservative voters who have already, in the Mark Foley Page scandal, that was sort of, hit them a bit. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see if they're going to come out or if they're going to just be disillusioned and stay home.
Let's get a little of the sound of the week in our ears. President Bush here campaigning in Tom DeLay's, the disgraced Tom DeLay's old district in Houston. At a rally Tuesday, he said again, the U.S. must stay and finish the job in Iraq.
Our enemies hope these violent images will cause us to lose our nerve and pull out before the job is done. They don't understand the United States of America. We will not run from thugs and assassins.
A lot of messages out there on the other side. Campaign ads heating up. Here's one featuring soldiers and retired general and former Democratic presidential candidate Wesley Clark in an ad paid for by the Vote Vets Action Fund.
Because of Iraq.
Because of Iraq, Osama bin Laden is still a threat.
Because of Iraq, our military is spread too thin.
Because of Iraq, there are more terrorists in the world.
Because of Iraq, America is less secure. So if you see commercials telling you to be afraid of terrorism, remember, it's because of Iraq.
Because of Iraq, boom, 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 goes the Democratic message there. And Andrew Stone, as you say, Iraq kind of at the heart of everything this week, and in an unexpected way, after John Kerry's comments about how those who don't go to Iraq, this funny debate over who's more stupid in this country. President Bush saying, you know, they're calling our troops stupid. Tom Friedman, New York Times today, and others saying, you know, who thinks you're stupid? Well, Karl Rove and George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld think you're stupid if you buy what they've been selling. What a peculiar conversation to be having in the last week, Andrea.
It really is. And it's also interesting who's stupid, who's not stupid, who's insulting the troops. And John Kerry, of course, who built his, you know, his presidential run 2 years ago on being a veteran, is getting this kind of, criticism from Republicans who'd never served in the military. So it's interesting. You know, I was up in Connecticut earlier this week with one of the most embattled Republican incumbents, Chris Shays, and he is... You know, a lot of Republicans this year are trying to talk about anything except Iraq. They'll talk about the war on terrorism. They'll talk about local issues. Mm. But here's a guy who brags, he says, I'm not reluctant to tell you that I know more about Iraq than any member of Congress. He's been there more than anybody. He's been there 14 times. And so he can't really run away from it. So he's going around campaigning against Diane Farrell, who is Westport, Connecticut, first select woman, former. And she pretty close 2 years ago and is running again and is doing much better. The latest polls actually have her ahead. He goes around saying, you know, I'm not one dimensional. I brought home the bacon, for the district, and I do all these other things. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's got to talk about Iraq. And he, you know, I think he is sort of resigned that that's going to be it. You ask him, well, if you lose on Tuesday, what will it be? And he said... She said to me, it'll be Iraq and the fact that people here don't like George Bush.
But then this back and forth put Iraq right back in front of everybody. We got to hear it one more time. Senator John Kerry, here he was at Pasadena City College Monday, got himself into trouble. Here's what he said.
We're here to talk about education, but I want to say something before that. You know, education, if you make the most of it, you study hard, you do your homework, and you make an effort to be smart, you can do well. If you don't, you get stuck in Iraq.
And the president coming right back the next day at a political rally in Georgia responding to those remarks.
The members of the United States military are plenty smart, and they are plenty brave. And the senator from Massachusetts owes them an apology.
Okay, so there we go. How do you say dunderhead with this remark? On the other hand, immediately, who thinks the American public is more stupid? Tom Friedman writing in the New York Times today, that the Bush team's real and deadly insults to the U.S. military over the past 6 years by hyping and exaggerating. He's saying, let's look at the record on the war if you want to know who's trying to mislead the country. Bill McKenzie, what do you make of this back and forth?
Well, I don't think Kerry's remarks are necessarily going to motivate more people to go to the poll. I think what it proves is Kerry was wooden before he said it. Kerry was wooden while he said it, and Kerry is wooden afterwards. You know, he's just a wooden figure. I don't think it is going – my own reading of that is I think it was pretty clear he was talking about Bush. It just shows how clumsy a politician he is. And if I were in the Democratic fold, I'd sure be looking for somebody different. I think this may have been his Ed Muskie moment where this may be the farewell to John Kerry. But on the other side, we had Bush this week saying, telling the wire services that he thinks that Rumsfeld and Cheney have done a fantastic job. I talked to the White House, as I said yesterday, about this and said, I don't get this. Explain this to me. They said, well, the question was put to him by one of the wire reporters. It wasn't something that they brought up. And Bush responded as he did, saying a fantastic job. And I said, well, you know, or is this about playing to the base? They said, that's a bunch of baloney. They didn't play in the base. He just answered the question. Okay, so that's their take on it. I still don't get it. Rumsfeld is a lightning rod. We know that. We're getting Jim Baker and a group of bipartisan folks who are getting ready to come back with some new proposals about Iraq. For the life of me, I don't see how Rumsfeld is the guy who's now going to be able to pivot and take these options and go translate them into perhaps different strategies in Iraq. So I don't know why Bush answered the question he did. I personally wish he hadn't. Cheney, obviously, he's not going to remove Cheney, and good reason he shouldn't. It's a constitutional issue and all that. But the Secretary of Defense is his own, is a lightning rod. I don't know why he did that 4 or 5 days before the election. In my book, that perhaps is a bigger problem for Republicans than Kerry saying what he said.
Jack Beatty, how do you read this who thinks the country's more stupid debate here? I mean, John Kerry sort of mangling it on the stump there. George Bush throwing his arm around Donald Rumsfeld, even as all these numbers look so terrible out of Iraq. How do you think American voters are looking at this, Jack?
Well, I agree with Bill entirely. I think this was a gaffe of tremendous proportions. You know, in New Jersey, Tom Kane Jr. is running ads calling for Rumsfeld's resignation. Mm-hmm. Republicans all over the country, especially the further north you get, are talking about, well, we have to reconsider Rumsfeld. And here the president and Rumsfeld is a symbol of failure, of incompetence. And the president, it was gratuitous. He doesn't have to say that. He wants to. What he needs to do is to give a signal that he's open to change. He was trying to do that a while ago.
He has been trying to signal he's open to change.
That's right.
Now
that's
he
right.
Just and steps in it.
And now he just completely steps in it with this Rumsfeld thing. It is really passing strange indeed.
Of course, it's not clear who'd want that job in the last 2 years of the Bush administration with Iraq.
That'd be some buggy to ride home in. Let me begin to bring our listeners in. Andrew, do you have something there?
No.
This is Bill. Yeah. Actually, there are people out there, like David Boren, who is a conservative Democrat, the chancellor of the University of Oklahoma, when he was in the Senate, knee-deep in Senate intelligence affairs. There are people out there who could come in for the next 2 years. And I don't know if Boren is a good manager, but he is the profile that could work.
Well, Lord knows the country needs a good hand on that tiller. Let me turn to our listeners from Nashua, New Hampshire. Chaitin is calling. Hi, Chaitin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, my point is that the American media, including NPR, is presenting the bad news coming out of Iraq only as if it's happening because of America's, America is to be blamed for that. You know, I'm not an American, but I can tell you that most of the bad news coming out of Iraq, I feel that the Iraqis themselves are responsible. I mean, if the Sunni and the Shia communities want to ethnically cleanse Iraq of the other community, and they are killing each other like crazy, I mean, is America to be blamed or...
Well, Chaitin, I hear exactly what you're saying, and at the end of the day, it's the Iraqis' country, but we've got 140,000 American soldiers in the middle of that.
Right, that's right. You know, so I think America is trying their best to help the people, but if the people happen to be the wrong people to be helped, I think the American media should be presenting things in that manner. I mean...
Chaitin, we've got it. Jack Beatty, let me turn to you on this. I mean, it may – one wonders, with Stephen Hadley headed to Baghdad, with Negroponte, the intelligence chief there right now, if indeed the White House is thinking along the lines of our caller here, saying we want to open up some space with this government, make it their problem, not ours.
Well, I think that option is on the table for them. It has to be, and the government in Iraq isn't making it any easier for them. Or you can put it another way, it is making it easier for them. By again and again, Andrea mentioned one incident. There was an incident a week ago interfering in U.S. operations that aimed to protect U.S. soldiers, at least in part. For their the Maliki government doing that for its Shiite base. You know, we are sacrificing our blood and treasure for these people. $6 million a day or something. And this man, this government is saying, no, you can't do that. You can't search for that soldier because, you know, our... the people don't like it in Sadr City. Well, that's too bad about them.
Well, maybe, Jack, but they've got their own politics there, too, and we're right in the middle of them. Let me take a call from Pete in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Pete, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
On the question of do the parties think we're stupid, I have a flyer here that says, vote and get spending under control. By electing fiscally responsible leaders, we can balance the budget, reduce the deficit, end wasteful spending.
And is it for a Democrat or a Republican,
Pete?
This
was sent to me by the Rhode Island Republican State Central Committee.
So how do you think the Republicans are doing on balancing the budget and controlling the deficit?
They think we're stupid.
Bill McKenzie?
I mean, I'm sorry. They have, you know, gone way out of control in the balancing the budget. They've increased the deficit. They've multiplied wasteful spending. And they think that the electorate doesn't realize what it is that they're doing.
Peter, we've got it. Bill McKenzie, here's a voter who knows how to read a spreadsheet. It's not tough on the national budget. I mean, this is a tough one for conservatives. How are you hearing them talk about it in your state in the races you're following? Or are they?
Well,
the deficit spending?
When the Republicans that I have talked to, I was in East Texas the other day, and I was last night actually talking to a Republican men's group in a fairly conservative suburb. I think they're more in the defensive posture. They really aren't trying to whack away at their own problems with the deficit. They're trying to explain away issues like Mark Foley. They're trying to explain away some of the problems that we're having in Iraq. So I think they're in the defensive posture, which is only – more anecdotal evidence that they may see a storm coming their way, whether again it gets the House, whether it gets
I'm sorry, Bill. Andrew, I wanted to turn to you on that. I mean, that's difficult because for years the Republican Party has been kind of training its base to respond to the deficit and spending hot button like almost nothing else.
It's really amazing that the Democrats are the fiscal conservatives in this election, or at least that's how they're playing themselves. And when Republicans talk about tax and spend Democrats, that's not what you hear. Going back, because I was there most recently back in Connecticut with Chris Shays, he held up he had this booklet, 54 pages of, he's been in Congress almost 20 years and all the things that he's done. And a couple of pages was all the earmarks, which are federal grants, which the conservative Republicans rail against. You know, the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska, which got killed, and he told, you know, this was a Rotary Club luncheon, and he was saying, look, a lot of people talk about, you know, Bridges to Nowhere, but look at all these really good things that I brought home for you. And, you know, that's being repeated 435 times, in the country. Is that every congressman hates earmarks and hates, wasteful spending, except when it comes to their district. Then it's really good stuff.
And our caller, Peter, says we're not fooled here. Jack?
Yeah, you know, if you just dial back to 1994, the Republican Revolution came in, I'm quoting from the contract with America, they promised to end Congress's cycle of, quote, scandal and disgrace. They promised to balance the budget. They promised ethics in government. They promised down with the lobbyists who are running the government for the Democrats. And look what they have produced. You see, I think there is among Republicans, especially conservatives in the country, a tremendous disillusion with this party in government. There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal today about J.D. Hayworth's race out in Arizona, and it goes to a Kiwanis club in a town where he's speaking, and a Republican, the vice president of the club, says that he's angry at Hayworth. He says he personifies, quote, this is quoting from the man, the slam and bash and tear and disgrace partisanship of his party. I think there's a lot of that among Republicans. This isn't what they signed up for.
Let us hear from the road where Andrea's been, and then from Bill. Andrea, first to you, what about that? Do you see circling the wagon, sort of digging in to save the majority? Do you see disillusionment in the GOP?
I think some of the conservative Republicans are secretly hoping that the Republicans lose control so that they can, you know, get back to this, what they see as the soul of the party, that they feel that their party has gone astray. And, I mean, I know Mike Pence, who is the head of the Republican Study Committee, which is the House conservatives. You know, mark my words, if the Republicans take over the House, he's going to make a bid for to become the leader. Because, you know, he and other conservatives really feel that while the leadership has sort of talked the talk, they haven't walked the walk. And that they feel they need to sort of cleanse the party. Maybe, you know, losing is really, you know, better than winning, because if you win, you don't have to make any changes.
Bill McKenzie, that's a thought we don't want to stuff into GOP heads if it's not there. This is kind of your turf. Are you hearing an echo of this or not?
Let me argue an alternative point here. Mm-hmm. I mean, the deficit is down from about $400 billion at the beginning of this year, I believe, to around $250. So at least it's going in the right direction. Let me also argue that the one person who wanted to take on the long-term national debt issue was George W. Bush when he went out to try to overhaul Social Security. And who is the person who keeps talking about wanting to do entitlement reforms in the next 2 years? George W. Bush. So far, I haven't seen many Democrats rush out, with the exception of a few, to want to shake his hand and say, yes, let's try to do something on Social Security, and yes, let's try to do something on Medicare.
So it's hunky-dory on the deficit and spending?
No, I can't. Mm-hmm. Defend. I personally would start ending some of the tax cuts that they want to extend beyond 2010. I'd be more selective in that. I'm not here to argue that the deficit is a good situation. What is the real problem, though, is the long-term national debt, which off the top of my head, I think is still someplace around $7 to $8 trillion.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news this hour. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. William McKenzie is with us. He's editorial columnist at the Dallas Morning News. Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today, been out on the hustings with all kinds of candidates. Jack Beatty's here as well. Of course, it's not only politics out there this week. There's a lot to be said about it. On Monday, though, the UK released a 700-page report on the economic costs of global warming. Here's Prime Minister Tony Blair saying the world needs to act now.
The consequences for our planet are literally disastrous. And this disaster is not set to happen in some science fiction future many years ahead, but in our lifetime.
And then, just when it all seems to be too much, a molecule found in red wine helps mice live longer, maybe you too, even if you're living a little too large. Harvard Medical School researcher David Sinclair explains here.
Resveratrol is found in many plants, although the levels that you need to get these effects are quite high. In fact, you'd probably have to drink 100 glasses of red wine a day to get the amounts, and that would not be advisable.
100 glasses of red wine, maybe more than anybody needs, but maybe they'll fish it out of there somehow, that molecule, and help us out here. Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York, and Alice. Hi, Alice. You're on the line. The air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
That last comment makes me laugh. First of all, I wish the commentators were politicians or the politicians were that smart. But as far as the campaign goes, it's one of the dirtiest I've ever heard, and I've been voting for years. And I think to bring this evangelical minister into it, the purpose of which I don't understand, about his supposedly homosexual tendencies is asinine.
I mean, I guess it's happened, I don't understand why it came out exactly now, but this has been an outspoken opponent of gay marriage, has been on the phone for White House briefings. I'm reading here now, this is, of course, Ted Haggard at the Colorado Church, the acting senior pastor at the New Life Church there, Ross Parsley, telling KKTV of Colorado Springs that Haggard has admitted that the accusations were true of monthly trysts with a male prostitute. It is ugly, and it's right in our laps right now. Andrea, is this part of ugly campaigning? Does it look like deliberate placing of this news story right now? How do you read this one?
Just from what I've read, it sounds like this male prostitute decided to come out you know, when he did about this news, because this is on the ballot in Colorado. And I think he wanted to expose what he saw as a hypocrisy on the part. I mean, this is while he's not as well known as Jerry Falwell or James Dobson, this is a very high ranking person. As you said, he's consulted with the White House on politics.
And gay marriage is on the ballot in Colorado.
It is on the ballot there, and it's on the ballot in several other states around the country. You know, you remember 2 years ago it was on the ballot in 13 states and passed. And so this is definitely an issue that will come back up in Congress, where a federal amendment has been talked about before but hasn't got the votes. But going to the negative campaigning, it's really, I mean, it's always gets nasty, but I think the nastiness level is really up there. And I think that kind of tells you just how much is at stake. We've got, you know, the governor of Oklahoma is being, you know, compared to Adolf Hitler. And we've got, you know, North Carolina Congressman Brad Miller is, you know, the one ad says that he wants to have one big fiesta for illegal aliens and homosexuals. I mean, it's nasty out there. Back up in Connecticut, the NRCC or one of the Republican groups was sending out mailers showing Diane Farrell, the Democrat, having, you know, a coffee table talk with the Taliban. I mean, really crazy stuff up there.
Jack Beatty, it almost gets absurd at some point.
It does. And the president has come, you know, close to some of this stuff and intimating that, that somehow a vote for the Democrats would be a vote for the enemy. There was a sign when he was visiting down in that delayed district that went, encourage terrorists, vote Democrat. You know, there are a lot of ugly things going on. And unfortunately, 600 new ads. I say unfortunately because they're bound to be assaults on everybody's sensibilities. 600 new ads are going to come out over this week. And many of them will have charges in them that'll simply be wild beyond belief, but there'll be no time to correct them. And we don't know which party will have more of them, but I have a strong suspicion. You know, as to this Ted Haggard, Josh Marshall, our friend Talking Points memo writes, he says, this was the conservative equivalent of Jesse Jackson's getting caught wearing a hood at a Klan cross burning.
Well,
but you know, there's a interesting thing about Ted Haggard, if it is true, is Ted Haggard actually has been kind of a moderate within evangelicalism. You going back to your intro of this segment, Ted Haggard has been one of those evangelicals that had been pushing the White House to do more about global warming. There was a number of evangelicals, also Rick Warren being one of them, been concerned about the issues like poverty. So Ted Haggard has not been just Mr. Social Cultural Conservative. He has been the guy who's been out there and, as I recall, kind of got yanked back by other members of the National Association of Evangelicals for going too far out on pushing
the environment
on global
front.
Warming. Mm-hmm. So if this is true and he is toppled, well, from my vantage point, that's bad for evangelicalism in a broader sense, because here's one of your moderate leaders, and they don't have just an abundance of them, who is would be gone.
A tough week for Reverend Haggard and his family and his church. Andrea, I want to go to you on the Senate side. I mean, you and Jack are both talking about some potential pretty big swing to the Democrats in the House. Senate, from everything I'm reading, very close here, still in play. Probably comes down to Missouri, Tennessee, and Virginia. Is that how you see it, Andrea? And how do those races look?
Well, I certainly hope so, because I'm planning to be in St. Louis on election night, where Claire McCaskill, the Democrat, is in a very, very tight race with Jim Talent, the incumbent. And, you know, they always call, you know, Missouri the bellwether state, because they always seem to vote for the winner in the presidential contest. And it's always looked at as, you know, as Missouri goes, so goes the nation. So that will be a key race. And, of course, here in our backyard in Virginia, that wasn't even supposed to be a race. George Allen, you know, he was already looking past next Tuesday to the presidential election in 2008, and then he had a series of gaffes and missteps. And, you know, and that has been a very dirty campaign. Jim Webb, who is a former Republican Navy secretary and who's running now as a Democrat, and he said a few things back in his past, which I guess he would rather he hadn't. So that's a real close one. And Tennessee was really close. It's now looking like Harold Ford may not pull it out to take back that seat for the Democrats, which is being vacated by Bill Frist. Bob Corker has pulled ahead, but again, really close there.
I'm seeing here CNN polls, Jack. What, Webb over Allen, 50-46 in Virginia, the latest I've got anyway. In Tennessee, former Chattanooga mayor, Republican Bob Corker, up 52-44 in the CNN poll over Harold Ford. In Missouri, literally a dead heat, 49% each for Talent and McCaskill, with leaving the Senate in play.
Leaving the Senate in play, I really think it does come down to Missouri if those projections hold up. And what's going to happen there? Well, according to the polls, the stem cell initiative they have on the ballot, should Missouri conduct more research in this, is favored by 10 or more points to pass. Claire McCaskill is for it. Talent is against it. Will that help her? Will the Michael J. Fox ad, which was cut for her, help her? Or will that, in fact, put people off? You know, a decade ago or more now, Harriet Woods was running for the Senate out there. She was the Secretary of State. And at the behest of a Washington insider, she cut an ad of a Missouri farmer crying. You know, life is just terrible, and he's crying. That ad killed her. And people said, we don't cry out here. I don't know whether the Michael J. Fox ad could have any negative effect like that. But I'm always leery when these out of state experts come in and say, here's what you need, because they miss the tone of the state.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I was in Missouri a couple of months ago going around the state with both the Senate candidates. And, you know, Sheryl Crow, who is actually a Missouri native, has made, the singer, and who had breast cancer, has made an ad in favor of embryonic stem cell research. This is embryonic stem cell research, not adult stem cell research, which Jim Talent and all Republicans and all Democrats support. It's not controversial. It doesn't involve destroying an embryo. I think the Michael J. Fox ad, which got a lot of play when Rush Limbaugh made it an issue.
Right, said he was faking.
Yeah, I mean, he's going around not just in Missouri. He's going around all over the country supporting candidates who support this kind of research. And I do think, I think it will have an effect. Could it backfire? It certainly could. But I do think all the polls show, in Missouri at least, that the public overwhelmingly supports this. And there's another ballot initiative over there to raise the minimum wage, which also has overwhelming support and tends to be a Democratic advantage there. That's one of the issues that the Democrats have used around the country in their ads to say, the minimum wage hasn't been raised since 1997. And in that time, Congress has raised itself over $31,000. So
Labor Department numbers out today saying unemployment nationally has fallen last month to the lowest level in 5 years. That ought to work for the GOP. Bill McKenzie, what do you see on the Senate side?
Well, I can't disagree with what Jack and Andrea were saying on the analysis of Virginia and Tennessee. I think Tennessee will go for the Republicans. Virginia, I tend to think, will go for the Democrats. And Missouri is this toss-up. Can I throw in here, though, governorships? Mm-hmm. Another big part of it. We got 36 races. 22 of them Republicans are defending. 14 Democrats are defending. And some of the polling that I've been looking at shows, you know, like in Congress, Republicans are having they're having to do a lot of defending. They're on the defensive in some areas. In fact, in your own backyard, Tom, I think it looks like that the Democrat will take the Massachusetts governorship. Why is this important? It's because Republicans have used the governorships as really kind of their AAA ball club for a long time.
Right.
In particular, in the 90s, you had some really stellar governors. I would include in there George W. Bush. Whatever you think about his president, he was a good governor. You had Tommy Thompson, Engler.
It was a big farm team, and then they'd come right on up.
Right. So if you lose that part of that farm team, then that affects not just 2006 or even 2008. That affects 2010, 2012, has a big influence on who's coming up in your pipeline. And second, it has a more immediate impact on get out the vote in key states like Ohio in the 2008 election, which it looks like, and I'm not in Ohio, but it looks like the Democrat, Ted Strickland, has a pretty safe lead over the Republican, Ken Blackwell. So, you know, that's a place where Republicans, you know, such a pivotal state, they don't want to lose. These are really, really big races for the politics. They're also big races for the policy, because this is where so many different domestic innovations come out of.
Something new cooking there. Could see a change in the complexion of the state houses. A lot of listeners want to come in here. From Whitestone, Virginia, George is on the line. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a 30-year-old male and single. And I see a lot of people in my generation, in between the ages of really like 25 and 33, mm-hmm. that are not seeing this as an important election. It really boggles my mind.
We think the young voter is going to sit on the sidelines?
Yeah, you can almost use the education as a dividing line. People that don't have, you know, more than 2 years of at least a junior college see this as not important. And then those that have over 2 years and have gone through college and maybe hold good jobs and have careers see the importance in this election and how it could be and is really a referendum on the war.
Watch out. Georgia's starting to sound almost like John Kerry's accused of sounding there. But what about it on the young side? Bill, Andrea, do we see that? Does it matter? Is there a generational divide in this vote?
I was at a community college yesterday talking to a group about politics, and I was struck almost everybody when I asked, are you registered to vote, had registered to vote, and a number of them had voted early. So I'm going to disagree with the caller. I think this election does matter to people. I think it happens to be one of the hotter midterm races that we've had in a while, perhaps, certainly since 94.
Andrea, what about a class or education divide in where people stand in this one?
Well, I do think that the more educated people do get out to vote more. That's just always been the case. I do think when you get away from the war, and one of the reasons I think, and I was just doing a show with some high school students, a TV show a couple of weeks ago, and, they're concerned about the war, but it doesn't affect, when you go about the street, you could forget that there is a war because there's not a military draft. And I asked them about that, and they would they care more if there was a draft? And I think, of course, they said yes. But when you get away from foreign policy, some of the issues that, they're talking about the minimum wage. Well, a lot of people don't make the minimum wage. Even, teenagers, get more than the minimum wage. Some states it's higher than the federal. There's a lot of talk about the Medicare prescription drug program, which doesn't really resonate with young people. Social Security, again, it's far down the road. So maybe some of they don't feel those issues. But when I asked them, well, what about college tuition? Are any of you worried about paying for it? A lot of them said yes. And Democrats are talking about that, for instance.
So it depends where the issues intersect. Let me get one last quick call. John in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wondered if you could address the article from the New York Times about Duncan Hunter's people inserting a defunding of the inspector general in Iraq, who's been there since 2004.
Stuart Bowen, who's dug up so many instances of corruption, graft, bad spending, and he's a Republican. Bill McKenzie, what do you think of that? Why would a GOP Congress be dumping the guy who's been trying to keep tabs of the store there?
Yeah, well, it's crazy. They're stepping in it again, and this shouldn't be a Republican war or a Democratic war. It's a war of how do we get out of this? How do we improve this situation? How do we turn this around? And stories like that really aren't going to help the cause.
And Chuck Schumer, who is the head of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, just checking my BlackBerry a couple of minutes ago, he's already got a statement saying this is par for the course, just another example of the Republican Congress trying to avoid accountability. And it really plays into one of the Democratic main messages is that with Republicans in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, that there hasn't been any oversight and there aren't any checks and balances. So I guarantee you that you will be hearing about this and you'll see it in ads in the next few days. It's going to be on stump speeches.
Jack Beatty, it is fascinating. You can feel the old battle lines becoming somehow more porous here between Bill and Andrea and yourself and the callers. It's just not quite the same cut and dry trench lines that we seem to have been stuck in for the last 15, 20 years.
Well, in politics, there are issue positions and there are valence positions. Valence issues are, are things going well? Is the government competent? They're not ideological. And is it honest? And I think that's what's happened to the Republican establishment here with this Congress. That's an example of it. They're on the wrong side of a valence issue. They're not competent. Many don't seem to be, quote, strictly honest, if you look at the lobbying, and people get it.
Well, out of the trenches and very soon to the polls, and we will see what the American people themselves have to say about all this. I want to thank each of you for being with us. Andrea Stone with USA Today. Andrea, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Bill McKenzie at the Dallas Morning News. Always good to have you, Bill. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you much, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.